I would like to introduce our speaker for tonight. Her name is Neva S. She is our newest Region 3 trustee. Neva joined OA in January 1994 in the Silicon Valley area of Northern California, and we talked. That's where I came into OA, so we probably have had our paths cross because I joined in 1991. She and her husband moved to Southern Arizona in 2002 for early retirement, and she soon got into service in OA there. But getting into service at the region level, she served as at Intergroup as secretary, TSW chair, region rep, WS delegate, and intergroup chair. At Region 3, she served as recording secretary on the steering committee for 2 years. Then HP suggested that she fill out an application for a Region 3 trustee when Vicki's second term was expiring, and so here she is. So tonight she will be telling her story, and I'd like you all to welcome warmly Neva.
Good evening. Hi, I'm Neva. I'm a compulsive eater. Okay, it's a little bit low for me. Yeah. I don't want to have to slouch to talk to you. Well, as Judy said, I came into Overeaters Anonymous in the Silicon Valley area, Northern California, and that's actually where I grew up and was raised. I'm the oldest of four girls. I was raised on a 20-acre ranch outside of what is now San Jose, California. And being the oldest of four girls, I started to collect some beliefs and some behaviors that kind of went along with that. But my next sister was only 18 months younger than I was, so she got some of the good qualities of the oldest child. And so I was the introvert, she was the extrovert. I was the quiet one. She was into telling the story of the day separately to each person that walked in the door. And, she was the star. She was a straight-A student. They actually had my IQ tested when I was 4 years old because my birthday is in September and my mother wanted to get me into school, into kindergarten before my fifth birthday, because the school year started before my fifth birthday, and so they had to do tests on me to see if I was mature enough. Well, unfortunately for me, the results said that I was above average in intelligence, and from that point on, nothing I ever did was good enough for them. And so it's one of those things where after a while you just internalize it, and even when they don't say it anymore, you say it to yourself. And so I think early on, food was a way of comforting myself. It was something that was used to comfort me, for sure, when I was little. When we were sick, somebody made us a special soup. We got to eat ice cream, anything that would make us feel better, And so I had that association with food early on. It didn't show really right away. I'm passing around some pictures. It didn't show right away, at least during my childhood, because we lived on the ranch, and, my mom would send us outside to play all the time. So I was running around and wearing off most of the calories. And so it was really when I got into adolescence that I started to gain weight, and the doctor, when I had my medical exam going into high school, the doctor said something to my mom about, you know, how much I had gained since the previous year. And so it was really actually kind of dramatic the way he said it. He said, last year at 13, you weighed 130 pounds, and this year you're 14 and you weigh 140 pounds. He says, if you continue with this pattern, you know where you'll be by the time you're 20. And, you know, that kind of freaked my mom out, and so we went home and she put me on my first diet. She decided that bread was my problem. So the only bread I was allowed to eat were the two slices that she made my school sandwich with. Needless to say, by that time, she was going back to work, and we were latchkey kids in the afternoon, and there were lots of things to eat in the house besides bread when we got home from school. But we were still somewhat active, although in my teens, that's when TV became a thing. And soap operas in the afternoon and that sort of thing. So, you know, gradually I started on that yo-yo thing. But the yo-yo was always going a little higher. And so I was, you know, dieting off and on throughout my teens and my young adulthood. I married my husband when I was 19 years old. And he also had some issues with food, and we both grew up in families where adults drank alcohol on a regular basis. And it was a little more obvious in his household than it was in mine, but it was there. And so one of the keys for me at 19 getting married was that I could eat anything I wanted because I was, you know, a grown-up now. And he was old enough to supply me with alcohol even though I was still underage. And so we kind of had a routine. And at first it was social drinking, and he had issues with food as well, so the yo-yo dieting continued, and he'd go on diets with me. And then, you know, it was the thing with the diet was that, you know, I would always take off 10 or 15 or maybe even sometimes as much as 20 pounds. And then something would happen and I'd, you know, break the diet. And then it was just like, well, you know, I'm off the diet. You know, what the heck? Or telling myself, lying to myself and saying, well, I've lost this weight now. I can just, you know, go off the diet and I'll be able to manage it and keep it off. And, of course, that never happened. And it always came back. And usually with an extra 5 or 10 pounds. And when I was 24, I had my first child. And I didn't do too bad with the weight during the pregnancy. For one thing, I was blessed with an aversion to alcohol from the moment I got pregnant. Even before I knew I was pregnant, alcohol started tasting bad to me. And so it kind of changed the whole picture too, because I had developed a pattern where there were certain comfort foods that I liked to eat when I was drinking that I didn't eat so much of when I wasn't drinking. And so I didn't do too bad during the pregnancy, but the problem was that I didn't really take off all the baby fat after. And so it kind of continued, and it would go, you know, my weight would go up and I would get uncomfortable. Usually it was the way the clothes were fitting. And then I would find another diet, and I never went on the same diet twice. You know, it didn't work. obviously it didn't work. I gained weight back, you know, so it had to be a different diet. And so, you know, I went through quite a few of the fad diets over the years. And when my son was a little over a year old, he had actually been having some symptoms for a couple of months, and at first we thought it was a flu bug, but it would come and go and come and go, and he wasn't getting better. In fact, he was getting worse. And you know, I had taken him to the doctor once, and the doctor had kind of looked him over and not found anything and said, well, you know, it's just a virus, it's going to go away. And you know, so I waited a couple of weeks, and then my mom came over one day, and she looked at him, and she said, he doesn't look that good. You've got to take him back to the doctor. So I took him back to the doctor. The doctor decided, well, yeah, maybe something was going on. So he referred us to a neurologist, and it turned out, I don't know exactly what the pediatrician was thinking. He wasn't really hot about taking care of sick babies. And this was a weird thing. But anyway, so and I was not a very assertive parent. I was not an assertive person at that point in my life. So anyway, it turned out that my son had a brain tumor. And he was diagnosed at a little over a year, and he had brain surgery at 13 months of age. And it was followed by radiation and then, you know, for several weeks, and then chemotherapy that lasted for about a year and a half. And he was, he had a lot of after effects that didn't show up for quite some time because we had to give him time to heal from all of that trauma. And so it wasn't clear what was going to happen with him. But when he was partway through his chemotherapy, we started asking the doctors, because I had a plan. You know, when I got married at 19, I had a plan. And these days I call it my white picket fence plan. But it was, you know, that I had gotten married, and we were putting off having the kids until we could save up and put a down payment on a house. And then we were going to get into the house, and we were going to, you know, make sure that we had at least one car, if not two. And then, you know, and we were going to have this family. And in my head, it was going to be at least three kids. And so when my son was partway through his chemotherapy, I'm starting to ask the doctors, well, you know, what are the chances if I have another child that this is going to happen again? And you know, and they just kind of came back and said, well, this was the first case we saw of it, so we don't think it's going to, you know, there's very much likelihood that it's going to happen again. And so I got pregnant, and my daughter was born just about the time that my son was finishing up with his chemotherapy. The doctor that was giving him the chemotherapy was new in town, and she was a hematologist and oncologist, and she had opened up a pediatric practice, specializing in those things, but also just doing pediatrics because she needed like a bread and butter practice to pay her rent and so forth. And so since she was giving him the chemotherapy, and I was not very happy with this other pediatrician that only thought of me as a hysterical mother, I asked her if she would be willing to be our pediatrician, you know, because my son still had to see somebody and all of that. And so it was very interesting. It was sort of my first kind of venture into being kind of an assertive person and, you know, defending myself a little bit. But she kind of walked me through what I had to say and when I needed to say it to the other doctor so that she could still practice there too. Anyway, so we got pregnant again, and you know, and my son finished his chemotherapy, and we're going along with him getting over all of the after effects of that, and he did have some setbacks, and he had mostly fine and gross motor. He didn't seem to be too much affected mentally from his experience. Anyway, then my daughter was born, and I gained more weight during that period of time. And probably by then, by the time I gave birth to my daughter, I probably was in the weight range of around 180, and not very much of it came back off after her birth. And she seemed like a normal, happy, healthy baby until about 2 weeks before her already scheduled six-month well baby visit, when I started to see some symptoms in her that seemed really kind of eerily familiar to me. And so I called the doctor one afternoon and I said, I want to bring her in for you to look at her because I think that there might be something going on. And the doctor listened to me. And I took her in to the new pediatrician, and she did a thorough examination, and she left the room, and she was gone, and I was sitting in the room, this chilly examining room, with this infant in a diaper for about 15 or 20 minutes before she came back in. And it had taken her that long to talk that neurosurgeon into doing an MRI on my daughter. And my daughter had a brain tumor. And it turned out at 6 months of age, she had this. It turned out later to be the same tumor, or very close to the same tumor, but hers was more aggressive. And so after she had her surgery and radiation therapy, she came out of that a different baby. I had, you know, this happy, bubbly little baby girl up to 6 months, and then after her surgery and radiation therapy, they gave me back this angry, autistic child. It was hard to even feed her or change her diaper. She had a huge personal space, and it was difficult. So, you know, food was a comfort. By that time, it was getting beyond, you know, alcohol being a social thing. Alcohol was my sedative in the evening. I would eat during the day, and I would put the kids to bed at night, and then I would drink myself to sleep. And that still continued in spite of, you know, going on and off of diets. You know, I would try to control the amount of alcohol when I was on the diet, you know, like find a diet that would allow me a couple of glasses of wine or something. And, you know, I'm just being an addict trying to control everything. And because so much of my life was out of control. So by that time, both my husband and I were in and out of therapy as well. And I was still, like, doing volunteer work at school during the day with the kids and their school programs and stuff. And, you know, they got into early childhood education programs because back in the 80s, there was a lot of money for special ed. Especially in California, there was. And so, you know, they were in these programs, and I was on parent advisory committees and doing that stuff because, like I say, I was doing the food during the day and saving the alcohol for the evening. And so So that went along, and we, like I said, we were doing therapy, and my husband, his therapist, told him one day that she thought he might benefit from going to some AA meetings. And so he did that, and he stopped drinking. And by that time, we had... Oh, I skipped a piece. I have to back up a little bit. Through the years, the kids had medical problems, a lot of which were related after effects of their original tumors and surgeries and therapies. And so as... You know, as things went on, there were doctor things going on, which was part of why we were in and out of therapy so much, because it wasn't just over when they had their initial tumors. Things kept going on. And so in late 84, we had some friends over for a holiday celebration, and they had kids the same age as our kids, and the kids were playing together, and they were running around the house. And all of a sudden, there was this blood-curdling scream from the other side of the house. And I go over there, and what had happened was my son had gone into the bathroom, which was white, and turned on the light. And his interpretation was he couldn't go in the bathroom because there were monsters in the bathroom. What I interpreted it as later was that he was having some kind of hallucination or some kind of aura that was happening. But he was really, really, really upset by it. And so we had him checked out by the doctors. And they found symptoms, and they did more tests, and he had a reoccurrence in his brainstem. And so for the doctors down in San Jose, that was not something that they were prepared to deal with. They sent him up to UC San Francisco. He saw a specialist up there. They wouldn't even do surgery there with the brainstem. It's like all the major functions are there. They finally decided that they would try to do a needle biopsy to see what it was so that they could tell if they could treat it or what they could treat it with. And so he ended up being up there for about 6 or 8 weeks. And after that, we brought him home. He had a prognosis of 6 to 18 months. And they had given him an experimental chemotherapy during the time that he was up there, and it had made him really sick. And, you know, they thought that it had shrunk the tumor some, but they didn't know how long it would last. So we took him home, and he appeared to be making improvements for about 3 months. And then it was almost overnight. He woke up one morning, and we were, you know, dressing him and going through the morning routine. And there was something that he had been able to do the day before that he couldn't do anymore. And it just went from there. And he passed away in... early August of 85, about 16 days before his 10th birthday. And along with the white picket fence dream, he had a dream. He had been planning he wanted to go to Disneyland for his 10th birthday, and never got there. We kept working to get him back to a place where we could do it, but we couldn't. So, you know, life doesn't go the way you want it to go. And so that kind of led down that road to where in 89 my husband finally he tried AA for a little while, and then he went back to drinking, but because he was supposed to not be drinking, when he went back to drinking, he was doing it secretly. He would, you know, and so anyway, the second time that he got sober, it stuck. And he actually brought home a big book and left it on the dining room table. And he didn't leave it out for me, you know. He just left it there. And I picked it up one afternoon and looked through it, and I found the chapter to wives. So I went and found an Al-Anon meeting on the other side of town, so nobody that I knew would see me there. And I went to Al-Anon meetings for a couple of months, and then I figured out that I belonged in AA too. And so I went to AA. So one of the pictures in that little book that's going around shows a picture of me at a pretty high weight holding a cake at a table. And that picture was taken for my fifth sobriety birthday. My sponsor threw me a party, and they made me a cake. And it happens that by that time, I was in OA. I was already a few pounds less than I had been when I went into OA, because I got up to over 200 pounds between diets one time, and I started to have things like heart palpitations and cold sweats in the middle of the night, and, you know, like I was, you know, I was really, that really scared me. And so, you know, I went on one more diet. A diet and exercise program. I joined a gym that had, you know, this diet connected to it. So I actually found a little bit of the fellowship aspect before I came to OA, because that last diet I had been in this gym program too. Anyway, but, you know, that fell apart after like a year or a year and a half, you know, and they never lasted very long. And so I was gaining the weight back, and I was doing some volunteer work still, and I was carpooling with somebody, and we started talking about our kids, and she, you know, and just peppered throughout the conversation were these things like one day at a time and let go and let God. And it's like, wow, what is going on here? You know, I'm in AA. What program are you in? You know, and her program was OA. And immediately it was like, damn. You know, I still had this stubbornness, like, you know, I'm just not going to go to one more set of meetings. I can do this. But I couldn't. And I got back into the mid-190s when I called her up in desperation about 4 months later and said, could you please take me to a meeting? And so that's when I started OA. And I think that's really when I really started to get to the root of my problem. And, you know, I've always kept that feeling that this disease, you know, it's like it's about the food until it's not about the food. You know, so the physical manifestations that I have are not exactly the same as the physical manifestations that any of you had. But we're all here because we use food as a primary source of comfort, numbing out feelings that I didn't want to feel, trying to deal with life, trying to control feelings, trying to control life, trying to control other people. And so I got into OA in Silicon Valley, and I had tried doing service work beyond the group level in AA, but I still had issues with angry men. And whenever I went to the AA intergroup, I really went home kind of squirrely. But I decided to try the OA intergroup, and this was in Silicon Valley. And I decided to go and try the OA intergroup, and I wasn't really signing up for anything. I just wanted to see what it was like. And it was different. You know, there was a different feel there. But unfortunately for me, the second time I showed up, the secretary resigned. You know, and it's like, well, you know, who can be the secretary? And I'm like, well, I guess I could take notes, you know. And, you know, and by that time I had a sponsor that when we got done with the steps, she said, let's work the traditions, you know. And so, you know, so I started out there being the intergroup secretary. And then the next year, the chair resigned, and nobody there wanted to volunteer for that. And I had already been chair of some of these parent advisory committees. You know, it's like, well, you know, I guess I could do that. So anyway, you know, meanwhile, my daughter is still around. She's in a special ed program, actually within the first year after I got sober. We started to look for out-of-home placement for her. I was having a lot of trouble coping without my medication, both the liquid medication and then the food too. The interesting thing about that was that it took after we made that decision. You know, because I couldn't make it by myself after we made the decision to look for out-of-home placement for her. It took us 3 years to find the right place. And the interesting thing here, you know, knowing there's a higher power in my life, she was home for Christmas vacation from school. You know, it was like, okay, you know, all I have to do is, you know, take care of her and keep things kind of low-key for this next week until she goes back to school, just not get excited about anything. And I get a phone call one day, and that's the phone call from the principal of the program, the director of the program that she got into. And it actually was a private school that they also ran like 3 group homes for autistic kids. And even though her primary diagnosis was not the autism, she had enough of the symptoms and so forth that they decided that she fit their program. And so that was just kind of a miracle. And so that happened in about 1994. So she was in out-of-home placement for about 2.5 years, and she started to have some issues with, one of the things that showed up for us is we had her home at least every other weekend, sometimes more often than that, and she would have these odd bruises, and we would ask the staff at the group home if there was anything going on, if there was a kid that was aggressive, if she was having trouble, and they couldn't pinpoint it. And, you know, even after we said something, you know, they paid more attention and they still couldn't figure out what was going on. And then one day they took her from the group home to the school, and she was stepping down off the bus and twisted her ankle and fell. She had lost her balance, and so then she had to be in a wheelchair for about 6 weeks because of the sprain. And then we tried to get her up out of the wheelchair, and she had a lot of trouble walking because of the balance. And it turned out that she had another tumor. So we brought her home. And that was our first adventure with hospice. Which hadn't really existed in full force earlier when my son was ill. And and that was another real miracle in my recovery, was learning how to accept love and help from other people. Not just from the hospice people and from the doctors who came out and made house calls on a regular basis, but friends, some of them friends from that were parents of other school kids that she had been in school with. Some of them were program people, and some of them were from the volunteer work that I did at that time. And, you know, and they would come over, and I had one friend who came over, and she would just come over on a weekly basis and talk to me for a little bit and then take whatever I needed ironed, she would take with her. And, you know, and because, I mean, it was what she could do. And, you know, and I wasn't worried about whether things were ironed or not, but it was what she could do, and I could let her help, you know, and it meant something. And, you know, I mean, just all the, you know, just all of that love. And so, you know, it just, it was... This program has been a blessing to me in so many ways. And, you know, I just heard the message. Whenever I was at meetings, I kept hearing the message. And I kept hearing the message that I have to give back, you know, and that I have to give it away to keep it. And I do have a couple of sponsees that I've had for a long time now, but I've had many, many opportunities to sponsor people where it was a short-term thing and it didn't work out very well. And for a long time, I just thought of that's not my strong suit, you know. But there are a few that have stuck with me. and they get into service, too. And... you know, and that makes me really grateful. And but you know, it's always been so many times how this program has saved my life. So in 2002, my husband and I decide that we can do early retirement if we move out of California because it's too expensive there. And so we started, we had actually been looking around for a couple of years, but we found a place in southern Arizona, and he was an amateur astronomer, and he and one of the places that was really attractive was Tucson. And, you know, so we went down, and we landed there, our first trip down there in the middle of the monsoon season. The weather was wild. It was flooding. There was thunder and lightning all night. And it was great. So anyway, we started working with a real estate agent, and we bought a house, and we moved down there in 2002. And we were commuting like back to Northern California to visit family off and on. And you know, this went on for a while, and we both were working in intergroup down in Tucson. And then in 2011, late 2011, he and I decided to make a trip to Northern California to see a cousin. And it was like a 3-day trip, road trip getting there. And he had not been feeling as well as normal, but we had been planning this trip for a while. And, you know, I had asked him, he had called his doctors and made sure that his symptoms were, that he was okay to travel and stuff. And I don't know what questions they asked him or what he said, but, you know, he said he was good to go, and we set out on this trip. And the night before we were to go up into the Sierras where this cousin lived, we were in a motel room, and I woke up at 5 a.m., and he was dying. He was on top of me dying. his last gasp. And that was a pretty traumatic scene. And but I got through that. I finally found a phone and called 911 and did what they told me. And but he was gone. Just like that, he was gone. And I spent, my sisters came up from San Jose and got me, and I spent a little over a week with them. And then a good friend that I had met in OA came, drove out, no, flew out to San Jose to help me drive the truck home. You know, and again, you know, this is the kind of friends that I have in OA that with my introverted personality, I never had friends like this before I got into recovery. You know, maybe once or twice. But so then I, you know, I went home and I, you know, started life again without him. And I had I had service positions at that point. I already had been nominated to be our region rep and delegate. And you know, being in shock from the loss, I didn't really think anything about, you know, oh, I have to pull out of this. I can't do it. You know, they just nominated me, but I can't do it. I just went with it. You know, it's just like I'm just going with it. And they went ahead, you know, and they knew what happened. And they probably asked me, are you sure you're up for this? And I would just like shrug my shoulders and go, well, whatever, you know. And so they elected me to it. And I went to my first assembly in the spring of 2012. And in Region 3 at the assembly, they have, they ask a volunteer in the assembly to take informal notes for the assembly. This is your warning. You know, this is your warning that it may be more than you think it is eventually. It may not be right away as it was with me, but it may be eventually more than you think it is. And it may be the very best thing that you ever volunteer for. They liked the notes I took. And so they started working on me. They said, you know, in the fall, we have to, the recording secretary's already done two terms and she has to step down. And, you know, we think you'd be really good for this. You know, you should fill out an application. You know, so I resisted at first. I was like, I'm just like barely starting to come out of this shock, you know, by the spring assembly. And I'm like, I don't know about this. But eventually, unfortunately, my sponsor at the time was on the steering committee. Anyway, she and others, they eventually broke me down and they said, no, you just have to fill out the application. You know, reminding me I'm not in charge of the results, right? So I did. So I served for 2 years as recording secretary. And then I stepped down from that. It's kind, I don't know, for me it was an intense job. And I needed to do some grieving and I needed some space. You know, I needed a little bit of space. So I stepped down from that. But then within a year or so, I was back being a delegate again because a delegate was elected that stepped down. And, you know, I was one of the people in the inner group that was qualified, that could step up. So I ended up back at WSBC. And then at that time, I don't know if they're doing it now. At that time, they had a little get-together for the regions at one evening at WSBC. And, you know, so we're all gathered around this table in this room. And Vicki's standing up there. She had just been reelected to a second term as the region trustee the year before, but she's like, well, you know, I've got 2 years left, but I can't, you know, do it after that. You guys have to start thinking about who's going to step up and be your trustee in 2 years. You know, just kind of planting the seed. And I was really kind of fascinated watching myself sitting there, that I was not like leaping over the chair and out the door, you know, because I sometimes used to have those kinds of reactions when people would suggest that there might be something that might be of interest to me, you know, like that. I mean, because I was really kind of petrified of the whole recording secretary thing. But I did it anyway, you know, because, you know, when they suggest you do something, you know, that kind of thing. Anyway, so, you know, but I just kind of set it aside. I said, you know, HP, you can keep that and let me know if there's anything else I need to do about that. So it really didn't come up too much for me. Every once in a while I'd think about it, but I wasn't really paying too much attention to it. Until this last year, when I ended up being, well, I served another year as intergroup chair. I've been intergroup chair in Tucson twice. And, you know, I served another year as intergroup chair, and again, somebody had to step down from being the delegate, and they needed an alternate or somebody to go to WSBC, and so I ended up going to WSBC again. And, you know, but when I signed up for that, I was like, okay, I'm going to WSBC again. I wasn't going to WSBC this last time. It was the year before when I was there, and it came up again. But then, okay, so this, but then in this last year, I was, something brought it up to me, and I was like, well, when is the deadline for filing an application, you know, for sending an application to World Service? And it turned out that the deadline was like within a week of when Brenda was going to come to town and do a workshop so she could sign the application, and I wouldn't have to mail it to her. So, you know, it's like Neva's not really doing this stuff. You know, it's just sort of happening, you know, like the thought comes into my head and it's like, okay, I'll do that part. Okay, what's the next thing? And, you know, and so there, you know, there I end up, and, you know, and I'm like praying the whole time, okay, you are going to have, like, somebody else is going to fill out an application, right? Somebody I don't know from Colorado or Utah or something is going to fill out. But no, I'm there. I'm it. You know, and so, you know, it's like, well, all they can do is decide they just don't like me. And they didn't. You know, they didn't decide they didn't like me. So this is a really interesting job. It really is. And, you know, it's interesting in unexpected ways. And it's challenging. And I am really, I'm really in step 6 and 7 on this, in this trustee thing, you know, because I have my old ways of acting, you know, of avoiding conflict and just waiting to see who else will do it for me, you know, kind of thing. And then I've got these new ways that you guys have been teaching me over these past few decades now, of, you know, of just suiting up and showing up and doing the next indicated thing. And I get to talk to you again tomorrow night. And we will talk more. I will talk more about that then, I think. Am I done? I think I'm done.